Okay. So we should be able, oh, look at that. Excellent. Nice when the technology works the way it's supposed to. Thank you, Steve Jobs. Okay, that out of the way. I'll talk about that in just a second, because there's actually a, there's an important point to this. And in fact, I'm going to walk over here for a second. I'm going to grab the book for just a moment, if you don't mind. So first, let me thank Ann for the gracious introduction and for the invitation to come out here. This is the second time I've been out here in the last couple of years. The first time I came out here when I was just done with this book, I just finished writing this, and so I gave the first public talk about the finished product a little bit. And it was greatly appropriate to come out and do that at USC to start out with, because one of the people to whom the book is dedicated is the late Hayward Alker, who, of course, was here for many, many years. So it was good to come out and sort of give an overview of what the project was like there. Since then, I've given a bunch of different talks about this in a number of different places. And rather than simply rehash that and redo the talk effectively that I did here 2 years ago, which, you know, I could do. It's a time-honored academic practice to do things again and again and again, slight modification of title and publish it in 8 different places, right? Rather than doing that, what I want to do instead is I want to take the opportunity here to reflect a little bit, having written the book and having talked about it in a lot of different places, on the sort of reception that it's gotten and in some of the ways that it's sort of modified, especially the book and the reception to the book, sort of modified my thinking a little bit about what the study of international relations should actually be like. So this is less today me putting forward a paper, or as Tyler well knows, there's no paper. This is not me putting forward a set of a specific thesis as much as a set of reflections that I hope will promote perhaps a little bit of greater reflexivity about what it is we study when we study, when we do IR, what it is that we're actually doing, what kinds of boundaries we might need to relax. Now, the question about the cover painting, the reason I grabbed the book from the table, as you can see, it's the same picture, right? This is the picture when Rutledge originally asked me about the book, they said, you know, what would you like on the cover? And I said, well, my ultimate wish would be to have Kandinsky's On White number 2, which is this painting. And I said, of course, there's no way you're ever going to get that for me, because the Kandinsky estate doesn't really, you know, circulate these things. And when a private citizen goes and inquires, they quote you a ridiculous royalty fee. Apparently, if you're Rutledge, you can work some sort of magic on the back end, because they did it, and they got me the copy of this. Why did I want this? Well, there's 2 reasons. There's the official reason and the unofficial reason. The official reason for wanting it is because I think what Kandinsky manages to capture visually in this image, or in a lot of his images, is a very good pictorial representation of how I think the study of world politics should actually operate. A series of different things with its own internal sets of rigor, balanced in an odd way that doesn't necessarily add up to one single homogeneous narrative. Because I think that's sort of how world politics works, and I think that's how the study of world politics works. I'm not particularly interested in imposing some sort of general homogeneity on the way we do what we do. I think that would be kind of silly and counterproductive, and I think Kandinsky nicely underscores that in a visual register. The other reason, of course, I wanted a Kandinsky is because there's another famous book in international relations and political science methodology that has a Kandinsky on the cover, and it was published in 1994 by Princeton University Press, and it has 3 authors, and their initials are KK and V, and my Kandinsky is better than their Kandinsky. So, in presenting this book in a variety of places in the United States and outside of the United States, and I will be honest, when I say outside the United States, I'm mostly talking about Europe, where I've done a number of talks on this. I have not actually had a chance to present this in places like Australia or China. I've had some conversations with colleagues in those areas about this a little bit. One of the reasons why I wrote the book originally was to try to think about and try to underpin what the study of world politics would actually be if we kind of thought beyond the disciplinary binders that we have as U.S. international relations scholars. There are ways that what we think of as IR in the U.S. doesn't actually look like what is thought of as IR in the rest of the world. There's a lot more diversity out there than we usually confront. And one of the things in writing this book and then presenting it in different places, watching the different reactions, is those boundary lines become really, really explicit in the sorts of questions people ask and the kinds of reactions people have to this. My favorite when thinking about the reception of the book is the fact that there's large numbers of course adoptions for this book in Europe. Not so many course adoptions in the United States. There are some, But disproportionately, it's European graduate students that are having this text as something that they're being introduced to. And if you look at, and Perry Schwartz-Shea has done some really interesting survey work on this, if you look at the way in which IR is studied or political science is studied in the United States, we don't do a lot of training in philosophy of science. We don't do a lot of broad-based thinking about the structure of social inquiry. A lot of U.S. training is much more technical and much more, as I will argue, methodologically homogenous than you get in a lot of the rest of the world. So in order to set a little context what I'm talking about here, let me say a few what I hope are relatively uncontroversial things about the boundaries of or the structuring of the discipline in the United States, and then suggest ways in which those boundaries might need to be loosened as we go forward and think about a more global kind of IR in the future. So, a few basic observations to get us started. US IR tends to be pretty heavily dominated by quantitative and formal techniques. And that is the case even for people who are not necessarily doing quantitative and formal techniques. There's a question, it's usually proper at these a lot of forums for people to ask why you're not doing things this way, but when was the last time you went to a quantitative talk where somebody says, why aren't you doing qualitative small n case studies? Right? The question doesn't seem to be asked in quite the same way. There's a presumption that this is the gold standard, that this is how you do IR. This comes along, as I said before, this sort of methodological homogeneity with this idea that what we do when we study IR, when we study world politics, is test hypothetical generalizations, try to come up with covering laws about political behavior. It is a particular kind of methodological orientation that in the book I refer to as neo-positivist. It's not positivist because there were actual positivists floating around in Vienna at the turn of the century, and they didn't really care about hypothesis testing because they thought you proceeded inductively from basic units of experience and reasoned upward rather than testing hypothetical generalizations. Hypothetical generalizations is Karl Popper, right? So this is the kind of default methodological orientation of a lot of mainstream U.S. IR, to the point where it rarely gets questioned or talked about as such. One of the reasons why I wrote the book was to say science is not equal to that. That's one mode of doing social science. There are others. A lot of US IR features the analysis of large data sets, or as I said before, the aspiration to produce large data sets. This is not an aspiration that generally is applicable if you look at everybody else studying world politics in the rest of the world. Some people are interested in large data sets, but it's not the sort of default option in quite the same way. Another thing that's really interesting, if you look out at a lot of the scholarship on world politics that's produced outside of the U.S. Academy, is you realize how much of IR in the U.S. is state-centric or actor-centric, where what we primarily do is we think we've explained an outcome when we have been able to identify the motives or interests that drive particular individuals, whether those are biological individuals or state individuals, to behave in particular ways. There's a historical reason for this. It's the legacy of the behavioral resolution in political science, which I'll talk about in a second. But a lot of the default option for how we analyze things is this very state-centric, actor-centric way of doing things. Now, onto those characteristics, which I think, again, are pretty uncontroversial. Let's say something that's maybe a little bit more controversial, but I think still true. Graduate training in the U.S. is pretty provincial. And when I say provincial, I am thinking here specifically of a piece in this, the Waver and Tickner edited volume on international relations around the globe. There's a great piece on the U.S. Academy, which is written by Tom Bierstecker. And what Tom did is he went through graduate syllabi in international relations at PhD programs for top programs in the United States. And he discovered that some ridiculously high percentage, like greater than 95%, of the material that's being taught is English language from about 5 journals in the last 20 years. Very, very, very provincial stuff. We train our graduate students in the same very narrow set of things. And there's an entire rest of the world out there that doesn't get assigned very much. It's even rare within US IR syllabi, if you look at it and this analysis that Tom ran, it's very rare to find things that were assigned before the middle of the 20th century. It's very rare to find any, as if somehow nobody started writing about IR until Ken Waltz came along. Believe it or not, there are people who wrote about it before that. And that turns out to, I think, has a real serious effect on how we do things, right? The training that we do here is focused on these English language things, focused that are produced in particular journals, particular presses. And as I said before, from Perry Schwartz-Shea's work, we know that a lot of it isn't broader methodological questions about the structure of social inquiry. We just don't train people in that. And when you have methodology focuses in graduate school in the United States, you all know what that means. A methodology focus means advanced statistical techniques, or game theory, or preferably both, as if those were the only things that counted as methodology, right? So there is this very strange narrowing of the field. A lot of this, I think, can be, if this were a different kind of talk, if I were going to now talk about the history of international relations in the United States, I think a lot of this has to do with the fact that it's organizationally a subset of political science, which means that unlike in the rest of the world, where in a lot of cases IR is freestanding rather than being part of political science, U.S. IR is always affected by developments in other subfields of political science. So things like the behavioral revolution, which start in American politics in the United States, filter over into U.S. IR in ways that in other countries where IR isn't part of a political science department, those same developments don't jump the gap quite the same way. So the ways in which these defaults get set have a lot to do with the fact that until very, very recently, most IR programs were subfields. And they showed up in parts of political science departments, and most people who do IR in the United States are trained in political science departments and have political science PhDs. It's a sort of lock-in effect that comes in through this. All right, so this is my basic portrait of the way US IR works. And again, there's things that can be argued with in there, and we can certainly go back and talk about those a little bit later. But I just want to set that as the groundwork to get onto what I really want to talk about, which is the fact that I think we need to start moving beyond some of those things. Why do we need to do this? Well, in fact, this is actually how I end my book. The major reason I think we need to move beyond this particular conception of what it means to study world politics is because what Abraham Joshua Heschel referred to as the terrible predicament of here and now, there's actually really important stuff going on out there in the world, and I'm always a little bit afraid of the idea that somehow having a closed methodological monoculture or theoretical monoculture is going to provide the best solutions to the challenges that face the human race, not to be too grandiose about it. But I don't think I'm being too grandiose. I think I'm just being accurate. There's a lot of stuff going on out there in the world, and we better be pretty darn sure of the boundaries that we've set on the study of IR in the United States if we're going to rigorously enforce that. In the book, I try to give a bunch of reasons why I don't think we can be as sure about these things as we sometimes implicitly are. So I think we really need to get beyond this particular way of thinking about things. Another reason why I think we need to get beyond this is because you have the old notion of IR as an American social science, which means a number of things. It's entirely possible, as people like Ido Oren have argued, that a lot of our research agenda is shaped in ways that we are scarcely aware of by the national security imperatives of the United States government and its funding packages. We know very clearly that area studies was invented by the United States government looking for people to tell them about particular foreign parts of the world and what we should do in them, and we can trace funding patterns and see how that goes. Right? We know things about how Rand and MacArthur and Ford and all these other things have created notions of development. So there's a way in which IR, and I'm not saying it necessarily is just a straight reflection of U.S. foreign policy, but it might be. And so if we really want to think about a global study of world politics, well, we've got to take that kind of suspicion seriously. We've got to get beyond some of these things. This is especially the case also in a lot of places, especially in master's programs, IR tends to be job training, and it tends to be job training for State Department or for working in NGOs, so it's part of the same basic machine. I would suspect you probably get that a little less out in here in Los Angeles. We get it a lot in Washington. Where a lot of our master's students come in and have absolutely no interest whatsoever in anything theoretical or intellectual, and what they're interested in is getting a job with state or defense or whatever. Think about the incentive that sets up for what you teach. You teach things that are going to incline toward the reinforcing of a certain view of the world to make people fit into a bureaucracy in particular ways. So there's all these distortion effects of staying, of confining IR to this U.S. model that I think we've got to be kind of suspicious of. Also, as we now know from the work of people like Ole Waver and Arlene Tickner, my colleague Amitabh Chaira, Barry Buzan have this book on IR in Southeast Asia, there's more awareness of the fact that when you actually look around the world, what most people who work on world politics outside the United States do doesn't always look like the work that is dominant in the United States. Now, sometimes we get confused about this because we look uncritically at the results of the TRIP survey that they run out of William and Mary, and we say, oh, look, it looks like most people do the sort of work that we're familiar with. Well, of course it does. Who do they send that survey to? Political scientists. Where are those political scientists trained? The United States. Okay, well, look what you found out. The people who are trained in this situation look exactly like the people you'd expect them to. But most of the other stuff out there doesn't really look like work that is dominant in the United States. But because of the historical fact that IR has been really dominated by a lot of these U.S. research institutes and U.S. PhD granting institutions and so on, in a lot of the rest of the world, in fact, I would argue pretty much all of the rest of the world, the scholarship that is produced in the U.S. IR mainstream is always a part of the conversation. You can't get away from it. I remember being struck by this by giving a talk in Istanbul and having people sort of ask questions about, you know, stuff that was going on in ISQ. It's like, oh, okay, well, that's interesting. When was the last time we asked about the Turkish Journal of Political Science? Deafening silence, of course, right? They listen to us, we don't listen to them. And that is just generally the case, right? That there's a lot of other stuff going on out there in the study of world politics we don't even look at. Is the reverse true? No, we don't look at it. Now, I don't want to cast aspersions and blame. It's like somehow this is like our personal failing. I think it's more than that. I think it's the fact that the way we constitute the discipline of IR and the way we train people to be IR scholars makes it very, very difficult to read outside of what we think of as IR. We have a certain set of tools, we have a certain set of theoretical apparatuses, those are the ones we're familiar with, that's what we apply when we think about these problems. So somebody writes an interesting piece on Russian imperialism, and it isn't written in the language that we're familiar with, we go, I don't know what to do with this. And then even if we don't like the sort of mainstream US IR stuff, we still look at it and go, well, I know what to do with this, I can react to this in some way. Stuff that's sort of outside of our comfort zone, that's what we're falling through the cracks. That's what we're not getting. And so the thing I've been trying to think through is how do we reformulate or reimagine what it is that we do in such a way that we could actually have something more like a plurality of voices, so that we could actually take some of this other work and start taking it seriously in various ways. So my proposed redefinition here has two parts. One of them is the term world politics itself I want to talk about for a second. And the other one, back to the three boundaries of the title of the talk, is to briefly mention three things I think that have to be sort of relaxed in the way we study world politics in the future if we want to actually take advantage of all of this great global diversity and scholarship on world politics and somehow learn from it. Right? So, why world politics? Why do I think what we study in IR is world politics as opposed to international relations or anything else? Why do I like this particular term? Well, one of the reasons I like this particular term is because how long have I gone before without mentioning Weber? You know, 15 minutes perhaps? Okay, it's a record for me. So, Weber. Weber has this very famous definition at the end of his Politics as a Vocation essay in which he talks about politics as being the slow boring of hard boards. And I think that's a very, very compelling definition. One of the reasons I like the term politics in world politics is because it provides a corrective to the idea that somehow engaging in politics is just about thinking good thoughts or designing idealized institutions, that there's a difficult practicality to these things. So I kind of like that aspect of it. The other thing I like about it, again, you know, can't help it, I'm a Weberian. The other thing I like about the term politics is that it really signals what Weber would have called the legitimate domination. The fact that, to put it in a slightly different idiom, as Nick Onuf loves to say, the central fact about world politics is that rules make rule. Right? So that there are sets of hierarchies, there are sets of dominations that are legitimated. And most of, if you think about it, push back behind the specific empirics of what we're actually interested in this field, and a lot of it is about that. Right? A lot of it's about legitimate domination. A lot of it's about why certain kinds of inequities become acceptable, why certain kinds of concentrations of power become understood as naturalized or as inevitable. Right? We do an awful lot of that. So I think this nicely summarizes a lot of the kind of stuff that we are interested in. Why world? Why not international? The reason why I like world is because if we think philosophically about this for a second, the concept of world signals an experiential or a phenomenological totality. Right? A world is a setting that one experiences as a whole, right? As a bounded whole in some way. International is very limited, right? It's just part of world. Anybody who studies international would say, well, there's other stuff that goes on, but it's not necessarily, you know, not all international. World, no. We were actually able to talk about the general kind of experiential settings in which we make sense of our lives. The nice thing also about world is that it's bounded. A world is never equal with the universe. a particular world, a particular experiential world that one inhabits, or I think about the world of a student, right? It's bounded. It stops. It has points at which it ceases to be and encounters other people's worlds. Because the other thing, if this is a lot of what we do in IR, I think in some ways the biggest sort of thing that we study around the world when we study world politics is encounter. Different ways of negotiating encounter with one another. Are they conflict-ridden? Are they peaceful? Are they mutually improving? Does somebody win? Is there misunderstanding? How do we construct what we think of as the right way to go about this? A lot of what we do, I think, in the study of world politics is about encounter. And a concept like world politics points toward the possibility of those encounters in ways that something like international relations simply doesn't, because international relations already assumes the answers to all the interesting questions, because you've got states and they're sovereign and they recognize each other. So, in fact, all the encounters already happen. And what do you have? You don't have encounter. You just have A meets B. And then they do engage in a reciprocal signaling game and, you know, all sets of interesting sort of things ensue. We're familiar with all that stuff. A lot more going on out there. So I think that thinking about world politics, I think that's a big enough concept to make sense of what it is that that we're actually doing. Now, in order to make USIR more of a, create more of an opening to this broader study of world politics, I'm going to suggest to you there are at least three things that we have to think about relaxing within the way we study and train people in IR in the United States. Now, one of the things I think we have to relax is what I call actor reductionism. This is the weirdest and most abstract of the three, because we don't usually think in these terms. We're much more comfortable with terms like state centrism. The reason I don't like that term for this is because I'm talking about something that's much more fundamental than just focusing on the state. I'm talking again about this explanatory tendency that we have to reduce the social to individual motives and interests. And I alluded earlier to the fact that a lot of this has to do with the behavioral revolution in American political science, where there was a distinct understanding that social order was a secondary product of self-interested individuals doing stuff. So individuals act in particular ways, and social order is a derived consequence of the ways individuals act. For a long time, people thought, in the early part of the 20th century, they thought that identity characteristics would simply inevitably lead to groups, and then Manser Olson comes along and writes The Logic of Collective Action, in which he says, no, rational understandings of things mean that groups are actually a puzzle, so we had to explain why groups form, and basically from there, that's 1965, right? Basically that sentence, groups are not natural, groups form in particular ways, and the formation of groups is a puzzle, covers, what, three-quarters of subsequent research in IR in the United States? I mean, neoliberal institutionalism is just that, right? I mean, it's that basic insight right there. But behind that basic insight is this idea that somehow explanation means identifying micro-motives. This is far more pervasive than just focusing on the state, because what you can do, as they've tried to do in the Open Economy Politics project, is synthesizing across international comparative and American politics, is they say, okay, well, you just specify different kinds of actors. They don't just have to be states. But you take the same explanatory apparatus and you just plop it down on another actor. So instead of states have interests and those interests incline them to do things, you now say social groups have interests and they incline them to do things, or individuals have interests and they incline them to do things. Same story, slightly different punchline, but it's the same basic thing. Rational choice individualisms generally, I mean, it's a powerful analytic because it's scalable. It can go all up and down. The reason it goes all up and down is precisely because it uses the same explanatory logic at every level of analysis. Individual motives, individual beliefs, individual dispositions within people's heads or within governmental processes, and that sort of from the inside out propels behavior, and then society is just the aggregation of behavior. Right? That's the basic kind of, and I will use this word correctly, it's the only time in the entire talk I will use this word, paradigmatic, and I actually do mean paradigm in the Kuhnian sense by saying this. This is kind of paradigmatic for how USIR and US political science understands the world. Because you can plug in, as we've seen people trying to do lately, you can plug in ethno-nations and terrorist networks and run the same basic models and get exactly the same kinds of results. You just have to figure out where the boundaries of it are and what their interests are. And you just run exactly the same story, right? One of the main drawbacks, I think, of this way of trying to explain society, besides the general individualist reductionism thing, is that it specifies the actors in advance and looks for their choices, as if we knew already who the actors were. And I'm going to suggest that a lot of the interesting kinds of challenges facing world politics are actually not about what actors who are already constituted do, but who the actors are in the first place and what the arguments are about who those actors actually are. So let me give you a little graphic example of this, very simple kind of network representation. So you've got a bunch of nodes, a bunch of individuals, a bunch of actors, whatever. They're connected up in various kinds of ways, right? So here we just have a simple empirical. We went through and did some ties and sort of figured out that people are arranged like this. And if we just sort of stopped there and then said, all right, what makes these actors do things? We would have assumed that everybody at these individual blue points sort of conceptualizes themselves and their world as being individually bounded by those blue points. But what if they don't, right? What if that guy over there or that woman over there is in fact making an authority claim, right? I am the legitimate ruler of this territory. I am the person who is in charge of these things. I represent a broader collectivity. It's a dynamic you see an awful lot. I mean, you see it in states, but we miss it with states because they're so well institutionalized. You see it with civilizations. Somebody stands up and says, I represent Western civilization. Nobody can veto them because it's not like there's a parliament that you can go to. I stand up and say, I represent the United States. Somebody's going to come down on me pretty hard and say, no, you don't. But I can represent the West. Why not? Christendom, yeah, I can go represent that too. There are these broader sets of claims, and if those claims are made, and if those claims work, they're well received, what's the effect of this? It changes that whole network. And instead of being five actors, it turns into three. So it creates a network. By modifying the network, by putting in an authority claim and pulling nodes together, we constitute actors. So what does this mean? It means that content matters. Not enough simply to come up with an ex ante specification of who counts as an actor and then go and measure them. You have to actually examine what they're saying and how they talk to one another and where their patterns of meaningful social action yoke them together in particular ways. Right? Instead of saying, well, I think it's like the beginning of Sam Huntington's book where he says this. He says, people talk about civilizations, but the real actors are states and we all know that. How do we know that exactly? No, we don't. We just, that's the way Sam Huntington saw the world. I would suggest that we don't need to start with an ex ante specification. We need to look at how people are themselves actually trying to organize these things. And in fact, what that would give us is an entirely different line of research within the study of world politics, which you might call the mapping of the metageography of political authority. Who belongs together? What are the claims that are being made about who belongs together? And what is the sort of cultural politics of how those claims play out against each other? And my suggestion would be that doing that, rather than spending so much time trying to specify the micro motives of who people who we already think or actors who we already think exist, might actually give us a better sense of some of the really interesting contentious issues that are going on in world politics, rather than assuming that we always explain by reducing to motives of pre-specified actors. All right, so that's boundary number one. And again, these boundaries are kind of hard to get at sometimes because they're so tacit in the way we think about doing IR in the United States. So the second one, which is the one the book is directly about, is this boundary of science, right? And the basic argument of the book, which I'm not going to go through in enormous detail, but I am going to put up my 2x2 because I like my 2x2 because, yay, 2x2s. The basic punchline of the book, as you know if you seen it, is that there's no unified logic of scientific inquiry. This is silly. Philosophers of science have never been able to agree on such a thing. There's still live controversies about this stuff. So for anybody in IR to look at anybody else in IR and say, no, you're not doing science, is pretty much crap, because there's usually a way that it can be defined as science. A much broader, more inclusive definition of science can actually encompass a whole lot of different things. So in the book, what I propose is a broad definition of science, big enough to cover these different kinds of scholarship on world politics. Science has to be systematic, got to have links between premises and conclusions, otherwise you're just writing op-eds. You have to be subject to public criticism and improvement, otherwise you're just engaged in navel-gazing or ideological interpretations of whatever, or that famous exchange with the, I forget who it was in the Bush administration, who ridiculed the guy for being in the reality-based community. He said, we just kind of think things and they happen. Those aren't the people we want to emulate. Subject to public criticism and improvement, right? Possibility that you have to share what you're finding with other people. And I think the third thing in order for something to qualify as science is that it's got to be focused on producing some kind of worldly knowledge for whatever definition of world you would end up having to or wanting to utilize. The reason I think it's important to say that is because it differentiates something like the scientific study of stuff from the theological speculation about stuff, which would be about thinking, you know, about broader questions of divinity and creation, that kind of stuff. So I think those are broad enough to actually cover a lot of the work, the good systematic empirical scholarship on world politics that gets done in this broader global study of world politics, that if we have a really narrow definition of science like we do within the U.S. Academy, we miss, because we don't think stuff counts as science, so we dismiss it. Now, there's a lot of room for variation in this space, and so the majority of the book is actually dedicated to trying to flesh out what that variation would actually look like. Again, I'm not going to go through the whole logic of the book right now, but the basic argument is that I think if we think about ways of constructing knowledge or ways of producing knowledge, we make these wagers about fundamental issues of how the mind is plugged into the world. So we have one wager, which is this wager that's split between phenomenal and transfactual understanding, which is about how knowledge relates to experience. If you're a phenomenalist, you think knowledge is bounded by experience. If you're a transfactualist, you think knowledge goes through experience to penetrate and get other things. If you're most kinds of structuralist, you're actually a transfactualist because structures can't be directly experienced, but they give rise to experience, right? So if you're really into social structure, you're probably a transfactualist. So that's one wager. And the other wager, when I put on this angle up here, is the wager about mind-world dualism versus what I call mind-world monism. Mind-world dualism is simply the idea that the mind and the world are separate things, and good knowledge mirrors or corresponds to what's going on in the mind-independent world. If you put together the dualist notion with the phenomenalist notion, you would get our old friend neopositivism. This is what hypothesis testing is all about, right? Take hypothetical conjecture about the systematic relationship between variables, throw at world. Allow world to tell you whether it works or not. Argue for years and years and years about the meaning of particular coefficients. Come to some provisional resolution. Then somebody writes another article in which they retest the same thing. Lather, rinse, repeat. That's neopositivist social science. That's how it goes, right? That's what you're doing when you do neopositivist social science. And I don't say that by way of trying to belittle it. I'm saying that's how it works. It's a well-established set of techniques for asking certain kinds of questions, but only certain kinds of questions. If you were still thinking that there's a world out there, or as Andy Bennett likes to say, that there's a bear out there, that your knowledge is somehow sort of corresponding to or reacting to, but you think that knowledge can actually go beyond experience, penetrate through experience to get to the deeper generative structures that give us experience, then you would be a critical realist, and you would probably have large numbers of books by Colin White and Heikki Patamaki on your bookshelf, because they are two of the main exponents within IR these days of a critical realist turn. Though they're not the first, probably the first one to really start talking about it was Alex Watt when he started on his work on stuff. And so you end up with this idea that you can actually go past experience, come up with generative powers of things. Right? So if we have arguments within the study of world politics about the power of welfare states, or the generative potentials of certain kinds of anarchy, then we may be leaning toward a critical realist understanding. Now, not everybody in the world, however, not every IR scholar, not every scholar of world politics would necessarily buy this dualist presupposition to begin with. There is another wager, a counter wager, which is about mind-world monism, which is the idea that the mind and the world co-constitute. They're not cleanly separated from one another. And if they're not cleanly separated or separable from one another, then the idea that truth is correspondence sort of makes no sense. Because how do you correspond with something that you're not different from? Doesn't work. So, if you took a monist wager about these things, and again, I call them wagers because it's not like there's a definitive answer to this. If there's a definitive answer to this, then we would know and we'd just be able to move on. But there's not. Instead, there's a wager that people make. This is, provisionally, we think this is true, and then we're going to develop a whole series of things based on it. Mind-world monism. So, if you were a phenomenalist and a mind-world monist, you thought knowledge is bounded by experience, but you thought that knowledge was also constitutive of the world rather than being a reflection of it, you would end up being an analyticist. I've already mentioned Weber in one context. I'll mention him in another one. Weberian understandings of ideal typification. A lot of work in historical sociology works this way, where instead of coming up with a picture representation of the world or taking a picture and throwing it against the world to see if it's true, you design a set of analytical tools and then you use that to interrogate the world in particular ways. Properly understood, this is what rational choice people actually are doing. Improperly understood, they're testing hypotheses about rationality, which actually doesn't make any methodological sense, doesn't stop them from doing it and publishing it in major journals, but that's not really what they do. properly understood, and there are some really, really good thinkers dealing with rational choice stuff who are very clear that rational choice is an analytical approach. So Jan Elster, for instance, Jim Johnson, Rochester, other people who are really clear on this. So you've got the Weberian historical sociologist types, you've got rational choice theorists, and you've got, and this is a point I make in the book, somewhat to be a little controversial, but I also think I'm right, an old neorealist by the name of Ken Waltz, who's actually an analyticist. Read that book carefully. There's no hypotheses in that book. And when he says testing, he does not mean the same thing as is meant in a standard neopositivist understanding of testing. He means something very, very different. So that's a way of thinking about construction of knowledge. And I think there's a fourth one, fourth box, in which we think about the construction of knowledge by taking two other wagers. We take that mind-world-monist wager about the mind and the world co-constituting, and if we connect that up with a transfactual notion that you can penetrate past experience to get to its deeper wellsprings in some way, you would then end up with a reflexive tradition of social science in which all knowledge is rooted in the particular standpoint of the place from which the researcher stands and must therefore begin with a clarification of the researcher's positionality. You find this work a lot in feminist and postcolonial scholarship. You find this quite a bit in certain kinds of Marxist scholarship. You find it in traditional philosophy of science, sociology of knowledge-influenced stuff. Karl Mannheim is one of the great figures in sociology kind of working on this. Student of Weber's, by the way. And all comes back to Weber. And so the reflexive understanding of social science is that you generate valid claims by grounding them in a particular place, by grounding them in a particular location that the researcher occupies. Obviously, these four kinds of social science, four kinds of science, are going to produce different kinds of work. They're going to look different. But I draw this not as a set of camps that everybody should now go out and buy a flag and say, I belong to this one, and this is where I'm going to stand, and then we'll have border wars and so on and so forth. That gets really boring. What's interesting, I think, about the definition of science that I put forth, what I hope is interesting about it, is since all these fit in the same tent, in the science tent, it imposes a really interesting task on any of us who think we're doing social science, which is, okay, this is how we do things, and other people do things in different ways. I wonder how we could talk to them. I wonder how we could learn from them. What would that be like? What would the translation problems be, both moving between boxes? The interesting work happens on the borderlines of these things. So I'm doing neopositivist hypothesis testing, and I have a friend who's really into reflexivity, and I think, all right, what could I do about standpoints, and how could I operationalize that in my language? And then I produce something that maybe my reflexivist colleagues look at and say, that's not what we meant, but then the reflexivist looks at your statistical findings and says, you know what, I could take that statistical generalization, and I could root that in a particular productivity context of where you stand as a researcher, and the statistical researcher, neopositivist researcher goes, wait a minute, that's not what I meant. Of course not. What's happening? Knowledge is growing. You're talking to each other and engaging. You're generating different things. And then the field becomes much more dynamic. You're able to talk across as opposed to just drawing the boundary line saying, what you're doing is outside the pale. I don't have to talk to you about those things. All right, two boundaries. Third boundary, real quick, which is the relationship between what we do in the academy and what happens in politics itself, more broadly understood as it takes place outside of the academy. Now, this is actually a story that, or a boundary that became really, really apparent to me when presenting this book outside the United States. Because the question I always get, funny, the question I get in the United States when I present the book is, okay, so now you've talked about these four different ways of doing things, and so now how does real science relate to those other three boxes? What I get when I present the book outside the United States is, why do you care about science? Why do you care about this notion of science so darn much? And aren't you just reinforcing a boundary that we don't need? And I say, well, let me explain to you how things work in the United States. And after I sort of explain this, then they would go, oh, wow, I'm glad I don't have to deal with that. So there's a different valorization of this because science plays a particular role within the U.S. as a whole, right? The traditional U.S. version of the science-politics relationship is that academic experts are supposed to solve political questions. Right? Our job is to non-politically pull ourselves out of partisan strife. We're supposed to stand back, look at things with a clear, objective eye, and come up with solutions, which we then present back to the policymakers for implementation. It's not just step out to step out. It's step out so you can recommend back. And the value of recommending back is precisely that you, by being the scientist, have a non-political solution to something. So here's a nasty conflict that's going on. What am I going to do? I'm a conflict resolution researcher. I'm going to step back out of that conflict. I'm going to figure out what people's actual interests are. And then I'm going to give you a solution. I'm going to come back and tell you what to do. So science is about securing truth that can discipline power. Now, within the U.S., the antithesis of that is the idea that academic observers are somehow political, right? Which is that they're actually engaging in politics, and scholarship is itself a political understanding of things. And so the debate in the U.S. about politicizing of scholarship is entirely about these two, right? So non-political science versus politics. Way too simple a dichotomy. It doesn't really cover the different kinds of solutions to this that you find in other parts of the world, but it also doesn't even exhaust the typology itself. So I'm going to show you a little graphic that I came up with. Actually, I wrote this piece for the International Studies Compendium, and I used this particular diagram, which is a diagram of what you might call the sort of fractal splits between these different orientations toward global politics. So imagine different orientations toward global politics. We've got our people who like to contemplate, sort of think about, try to explain and understand it, and enacting. I want to go do something in global politics. I want to make changes that are visible. So here we have our classic science versus politics. I'll use the German terms because, hey, why not? So we have the Wissenschaftspolitik. These are our divisions between this. So we can have our scientists thinking about global politics. We can have our politicians thinking about global politics. But this is really simplistic. A sociologist named Andrew Abbott at the University of Chicago once pointed out that these big intellectual debates have a tendency to replicate themselves again and again over generations. So his example for this, it was the example that Dan and I came up with for talking about this, was you think about debates within a political party, and you're split between a left wing and a right wing, and what immediately happens? The left wing and the right wing fall to fighting among themselves about who's more left and who's more right. And so you end up with the same debate happening again at a lower level, right? So Abbott's point was that this sort of pattern occurs in a lot of things, particularly in the sociology of academic disciplines. So Abbott pointed out that if you had a division like this, that division would actually replicate over time. And I said, all right, so what if you took the Wissenschaftspolitik thing and if you sort of ran it again, you would end up with not two positions, but four at a minimum. So your pure type scientists who are really interested in contemplating stuff, here are your ideal typical scholars. But what about people who are interested in contemplating stuff so that they can then go provide policy advice? Well, these are experts, right? Not exactly the same thing. Imagine debates within departments between your applied people and your non-applied people, and you get exactly this. Think about the language that's used, right? Think about the valence of the word theory when it's passed back and forth between these two, and who's the real theorist and who's not a theorist. Or these people will call these people too theoretical, right? But that doesn't mean the same thing as that these people were saying. Because when you get on the other side of the dichotomy down there, you have your people who are primarily interested in doing stuff in politics, but then they want to step back and think about it. So you have your scholar activists, right? A lot of human rights work kind of fits in there. And then you have your people who are just really interested in enacting stuff. And these are your straight-up practitioners. Now, what's interesting is that the academy in most places, even in the United States, is actually populated by all three of those, not just one position. The balance of power among those three positions changes in different departments and at different periods of time, but it's entirely too simple to say, well, there's political and there's non-political. There's a whole bunch of different orientations toward politics and toward the policy realm that actually already empirically characterizes the kind of colleagues that we have. So we need something more than just this very simple kind of U.S. solution where science is about stepping out of politics to speak truth to power. So I have a slightly different solution that I prefer, which is the Weber and Dewey with the dash of Wittgenstein solution, because I'd like to get all of my favorite philosophers into every presentation that I use. I think a better way of thinking about what we do, or an alternative to thinking about what we do, is rather than standing back to correct power, what we do is we formalize practice. And it's tactically useful to provisionally separate from active politics for the purpose of doing that. And again, I think this comes sort of out of what Weber would have called value clarification. Our job as scholars is to say, all right, here's the tacit assumptions you're working with. Let me run those out more logically than you probably do because, you know, you're busy getting stuff done. I'm going to go through and logically formalize it for you and sort of show you what the implications of this would be. Parenthetically, if that sounds at all like what people like Jan Elster say rational choice theory is good for, that's not an accident. That's exactly what an analytical approach is for, is doing exactly this. Or John Dewey, famous American pragmatist, once commented, many times actually commented, but the specific quote I'm thinking of here is from his 1920 book, in which he argued that what we do as academics is we conserve practical insights, and we formalize them, we take them out of their local context so we can make them more broadly applicable, so people can look at them in different kinds of ways. We forge tools out of experience. And Wittgenstein called this getting a clear view of the way things are used. Right? So what this would do, I think, as opposed to thinking about just those, that sort of standard U.S.-centric debate about science versus politics, this would say, no, maybe we should think about politics and our relationship to it as our scholarship as a form of critical tool-making for politics. And what would that look like? Just because I was into drawing some graphs. So this is a sort of typical U.S. version, right? Politics, messy, bad. Ivory Tower Academy, science. Right? So science is up here. It's totally untouched by the nastiness of politics. And so occasionally you can like tell the politicians what to do. Right? This was the basic idea. If you go back to the founding debates of land-grant universities in the United States in the 19th century, this is the whole land-grant philosophy. Right? What's supposed to happen? Scientists are going to tell the farmers how to grow better crops. So science is going to tell people what to do. That's how it's set up. Richard Hofstadter has this marvelous, marvelous account of that in which he actually argues that that's a very anti-intellectual position, but we can talk about that later as well. This is the standard version. It's a lot more complicated than this, right? Because the folks within the academy that are just sitting around debating stuff have predecessors that they're drawing on. There's intellectual materials that they're drawing on. And where that intellectual material they're drawing on actually come from? Well, somebody at some point had to come in from, you know, that messy world out there someplace, or maybe this person just kind of looked out their window and saw something was going on, and they kind of brought it in, started doing stuff with it in the academy. You turn it into various kinds of theoretical apparatuses and conceptual tools, and then you have these debates inside. They're all rooted, right? All the stuff we talk about comes from somewhere, and they come from this messy world that we're supposed to be separating ourselves from. But while we're doing this theoretical scholarly debate up here, there's this other thing going on, which we usually don't talk a lot about when we think about the study of IR, which is the fact that most of us are employed at universities, and we have these people who show up in our rooms and offices. Students, I think they're called. And they come in, and they like listen to us talk about things, which is fascinating. And what happens? Well, sometimes they listen to stuff we say, and they actually do stuff based on it. Not because we've told them the right thing to do, but because maybe in the course of teaching, we've sparked an idea. And they've taken something from outside, taken something from one of our concepts, they've taken it out into the field, and they've done something with it that we would probably consider to be just not rigorous enough and not methodologically sound, and, you know, doesn't really come up to the right standards for a publication in a top journal and whatever. Meanwhile, they've created micro-lending and they've saved a whole bunch of people, right? So they do stuff without it necessarily being the same kinds of standards that we have. There's an influence that works that way. And sometimes, right, sometimes somebody will actually come in and they get changed by their experience of having sat in some of our classes and dealing with some of our debates. Why am I belaboring this particular point? Because far too often when we think about the relationship between science and politics, we think about it as scholars and we think about it in terms of our writing. We don't think about it in terms of the other part of a vocation, which is teaching. We have students who get influenced by these things. We have students whose thoughts we help to spur in different kinds of directions by the fact that they show up in our classes. And so rather than thinking that our job is just to tell them what to do, maybe we have to take much more seriously than what we do even when we're studying world politics and teaching about it, is helping people develop broader, more critical understandings of what it means to do world politics. Because while we're sitting here working on our theories and our scholarship, they're out there doing stuff. And in that way, I think that's one of the ways that we can fulfill, this is one of the epigraphs that I use for the book, this admonition of Stephen Toulmin's in the beginning of his marvelous book, Cosmopolis. He points out that we really get too wrapped up with the idea that knowledge is supposed to be secure and solid. And maybe what we really need to do is we need to think about our knowledge-producing practices and especially our pedagogical practices as preserving, I love that phrase, provide the elbow room we need in order to protect diversity and adaptability. I think if we're going to build something that actually is a global study of world politics, that actually reflects the kind of scholarship that goes on in other parts of the world, and if we're going to even make the U.S. Academy better able to deal with the sorts of pressing challenges that we all face, then this is the kind of thing we're going to need to do. And that's what I want to throw out to get us to think about a little bit.